Good afternoon. Good to see everyone here today. We were back here a couple weeks ago when Elmer Wilkie was here. And Elmer was talking to me before the sermon, and he said, "I'm sorry, Dave, you got to listen to my sermon again." And I said, "That's not a problem. You know, usually you listen to something again, you get a little bit more out of it. Maybe you'll have a little different perspective on it." And his sermon was on the covenants. And I asked a few people here in the congregation, I think in Denver, this question. What covenant was Jesus Christ under? I'll let you think about that a little bit. I really think that as we look at this, Jesus Christ was under the old covenant. Yes, from the time his blood was sacrificed, the new covenant was starting to begin, and I believe personally that it was ratified and done on the day of Pentecost when God's Holy Spirit was given, when everyone started in the New Testament time of the church then. But his sermon did stimulate this thought. I wrote this down. I was asking my wife about this as we were listening to the sermon. Didn't think of that when I first heard Elmer's sermon. But it shows you how things like that can inspire you when you hear it a second time. You know, when we think about the God of the Old Testament, especially most of the world, they think of God as this harsh God, vengeful, destructive. You know, quite different when they think of Jesus Christ, who is in the New Testament. He destroyed many things. I'm going to go back to the time of Joshua, and we're going to spend quite a bit of time in the book of Joshua today, because I found some stories that really link together, that tell a story that I thought were very meaningful. Let's start here in Joshua 1. We'll start out here with our story and start linking these things together. It gives us our premise for what we're going to read through in Joshua chapter 1, verse 1. "Now after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke unto Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' minister, saying, 'Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan River, you and all this people, unto the land which I do give to them, even to the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot shall tread,'" remember this, brethren, "every place that their foot would touch, would be upon, that have I given unto you, as I said unto Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, even unto the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and unto the great sea towards the going down of the sun, shall be your coast. There shall not any man be able to stand before you all the days of your life." Something that he wanted Israel to remember. "As I was with Moses, so I will be with you, Joshua. I helped him. I guided them. I will not fail you, nor forsake you. Be strong and of a good courage." And it's quite a pep talk that Joshua is getting here. "For unto this people shall you divide for an inheritance the land, which I swore unto their fathers to give them. Only be you strong, be very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left. Don't deviate. Keep it specifically, as I've told you, that you may prosper wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth, but you shall meditate therein day and night." Don't let it be just something that once in a while you think about. Think about it day and night. "That you may observe to do according to all that is written therein, for then," so there's a contingency there, "for then you shall make your way prosperous, and then shall you have good success. Have not I commanded you? Be strong and of a good courage. Be not afraid, neither be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Quite the promise, quite the pep talk given to Joshua as he is going to go forward into the promised land. Now we know that the first place they bumped into was Jericho, and great success. After Jericho fell, Israel went on to the next city, the city of Ai. It was a rather small town, about 15 miles from Jericho. So they're on for their next encounter. And after the great battle win at Jericho, Israel was sure that they would win the battle of Ai. But what transpired? 36 men were killed, and the army of Israel fled, ran back to their camp, wondering what happened. We'll pick up the story in Joshua 7. Joshua 7 and verse 4. So there went up there of the people about 3,000 men. These are ones are going to attack the city of Ai. And they fled before the men of Ai. And the men of Ai smote them, about 36 men, for they chased them from before the gate even unto Shabarim, and smote them in the going down, wherefore the hearts of the people melted and became as water. Quite a transition of events, isn't it? Joshua was perplexed as to why Israel had lost this battle. Why? We just had great success in Jericho. May have even thought of this and celebrated in our mind as God gave them this success in battle. Remember the words of encouragement that God had given to Joshua in that first chapter, those first 9 verses that we just read. Joshua was very upset, and he was very confused as to what had happened. Let's notice the result of this. We'll continue on here in Joshua 7 and verse 6. And Joshua tore his clothes, fell on the ground, upon his face before the ark of the Lord, before the very ark of covenant, even until nighttime, eventide. It wasn't just him. He and the elders of Israel, and put dust upon their heads. Must have been quite a sight as they were so distraught, beseeching God, what happened? You said we were going to be successful. And Joshua said, alas, O Lord, wherefore hast thou, why have you brought this people over to the Jordan to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us? You can almost hear some of the words of ancient Israel, the ones who had died previously. Would to God we had been content and dwelt on the other side of the Jordan, not even entered into the promised land where God had said all of this greatness was going to happen. Joshua's attitude was very confused, perplexed, you may say bad, but we'll go on and see how this story works itself out. O Lord, what shall I say when Israel turns their backs before their enemies? How am I going to talk to Israel? And what happened? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land shall hear of it. And it's one thing about it. When ancient Israel was moving, it seemed like the story went right before them. People knew what was going on. What happened? And when they crossed the Red Sea, I wonder if there were people that saw the event from afar. Or maybe their priests of their religion had this revealed to them. I had somebody tell me that in Denver the last time that I gave this sermon. But anyway, they knew after this event happened that it traveled faster than them going to the next town. For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land shall hear of it, and shall surround us round and cut off our name from the earth. And what will you do unto your great name, God? It isn't just us. your name, how will they look upon you? Well, God intervened and said unto Joshua, get up. Don't be on the ground. Why do you lie upon your face doing this? Why do you do this? Here is the reason. Israel has sinned, and they have also transgressed my covenant. The agreement that he had made with them, that we saw here in Joshua 1. We can even reflect back into Moses' time, Abraham's time, and various people that had a covenant, an agreement with God to follow him, to not have any other gods before them. So, Israel has sinned. I'm sure that Joshua was stunned, taken back a little bit. So they have sinned and transgressed my covenant which I commanded them, for they have even taken of the accursed thing, some pagan piece, some pagan statue or artifact, something that didn't represent God, but represented another God, and also stolen and lied, and they have put it even among their own stuff. Therefore, the children of Israel could not stand before their enemies. No battles were going to be won from this point forward, but turn their backs before their enemies because they were accursed. Israel at this time was accursed. There were no more battles going to be won until this was taken care of. Neither will I be with you anymore except you destroy the accursed from among you. So something needs to be addressed. Something needs to be done. So the process of finding out who had this accursed thing began. These words should have been in the forefront of Joshua's mind. We'll see here in Joshua 6 and verse 18. Here was an instruction that was given to them, and Joshua should have maybe thought about this, but God is giving him the instruction here in Joshua 6 and verse 18. And here's the instruction, what they do when they come into these towns, and you in any wise keep yourselves from the accursed things, these pagan idols, these things that would draw you away and make these people think of God in a manner in which he doesn't exist, lest you make yourselves accursed. And when you take the accursed thing and make the camp of Israel a curse and a trouble in it, but all the silver, all the gold and vessels, brass and iron, are consecrated unto the Lord. They're mine. I made the battle be won. They shall come into the treasury of the Lord. So God is emphasizing to Joshua that Israel needed to purify themselves and find out what made God turn against them. Why did he change his mind? We've just read that there was something amongst the camp of Israel that shouldn't have been there. So let's go back here to Joshua 7, and we'll continue on in verse 13. So here's what Joshua is going to do. He's going to get this resolved. He is a man that gets things done. Joshua 7 and verse 13, he says, up, sanctify the people, and say, and this is something he did immediately. I don't think he dilly-dallied around and waited until the next day. He takes action right away. Up, sanctify the people, and say, sanctify yourselves against tomorrow. We're going to do something tomorrow that we're going to get this remedied. For thus says the Lord God of Israel, there is an accursed thing in the midst of you, O Israel. You know, at that point, whoever had that wrong idol or that accursed thing should have known that they were going to be found out. And maybe they thought, maybe that won't happen. So, there is an accursed thing in the midst of you, O Israel, that thou cannot stand before your enemies until you take away this accursed thing from among you. So here's what we're going to do. In the morning, You shall be brought according to your tribes. First, they'll find out what tribe it is. And it shall be that the tribe which the Lord takes shall come according to the families thereof. So we'll have the tribes we'll pick out, then God is going to show which family it's going to be. And the family which the Lord shall take shall come by households. So now that you've gone from your tribes to your families, now it's the households, and the household which the Lord shall take shall come man by man. God is working his way down, narrowing it down to who it's going to be. So the process of determining who had brought this accursed thing was done by using the Urim and the Thummim. And this is explained in Exodus 28. The Urim and the Thummim was a breastplate that had 12 stones across it. It to represent each of the 12 tribes. And we'll see in Exodus 28 and verse 30, if you want to read a little bit about this, I'll read this for you. But here it tells about the Urim and the Thummim. And you shall put in the breastplate of judgment, the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be upon Aaron's heart, so right on his chest. When he goes in before the Lord, he's going to ask a question, and Aaron shall bear the judgment of the children of Israel upon his heart before the Lord continually to get that answer. So from what I can determine, the Urim and the Thummim would light up on a particular tribe's stone. You know, one would illuminate. And I've even heard some description that each tribe was represented by a letter. So if something needed to be spelled out, that could be done too. So it's going to show the answer as to what tribe had the accursed thing. And this was placed, as I said, on Aaron's chest and held in place by his vest. So by this Urim and Thummim, the guilty tribe was determined, first of all. And finally, the name of the person who had brought this accursed thing into the camp of Israel. At this point, once that person was identified, it was Achan. And Achan, at this point, what could he say? He admitted to his guilt of taking spoil from Jericho. But in this, we don't find him repenting. Because of his disobedience, Achan, his family, his livestock were stoned, burned, and then a heap of stones was placed over them as a memorial of his disobedience. There is quite a difference between Joshua and Achan. You know, Achan, once he heard this was going to happen, he could have come before Joshua and said, I have sinned, I've been wrong, I have this. And we wouldn't have to go through this whole process of finding out which family, which tribe, and identify eventually the person who did this. So if Achan had been repentant and showed remorse for his disobedience, a different outcome could have come to his family. Now, in chapter 8 of Joshua, we now see Israel able to return to Ai. This has been remedied. All this accursed thing has been taken out of the way. The family has been dealt with accordingly. And now they're able to return to Ai for a battle that they would now win. News of the fall of Jericho and Ai spread throughout Canaan. Yes. I fell. And this brings us to chapter 9. We'll continue on with this story. So, Israel is into the promised land. They're headed to take and procure all that is before them, all the cities. Joshua 9 and verse 1. And it came to pass when all the kings which were on this side of the Jordan in that land of Canaan, in the hills and the valleys and all the coasts, and the great sea over against Lebanon, all this that had been identified as the promised land that they are going to receive, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, they heard of all that had occurred. They knew what happened, and they knew the success that Israel was having. So they gathered themselves together to fight with Joshua, with Israel, and with one accord. And when the inhabitants of Gibeon, we're going to focus on this town now, when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done unto Jericho and Ai, they did work craftily. They thought about, how are we going to get around this? How are we not going to be destroyed? We have heard that everyone in their paths is killed and destroyed and their towns are taken. So they work craftily. They're devising a plan and went and made as if they had been ambassadors. That means people outside of Canaan. They want to portray themselves as people that weren't within the area of Canaan, and took old sacks upon their asses and wine bottles, old and rent, and bound them up. So they're going to portray themselves as being a people that were outside of Canaan. The city of Gibeon was located in the central part of the hill country, about 8 miles northwest of Jerusalem. It was the final resting place of Moses' tabernacle, if you'll check up on that. I won't take the time to read back there where that was at. Let's see, I have this here somewhere. I don't see it. It's in 2 Chronicles. Okay, I'll see this as we go on. So, let's see here. Where am I at? Here we have the final resting place of Moses' tabernacle. Going on to verse 5. So these people are portraying themselves from being outside. They're making themselves look like they traveled a long distance. They used up all their supplies, their clothes. It says here their shoes were old garments upon them. And all the bread, what they had, was dry and moldy. It looked like they'd come from an awful long distance away. They did all that they could to give the impression that they had been traveling a great distance outside of the area of Canaan. And the impression was to say that they were from, as I said, outside of Canaan, and there's a reason. And we'll see this here in a little bit. Verse 6, we'll continue on of chapter 9. And they went to Joshua unto the camp of Gilgal, that's southwest of Gibeon, and said unto him and to the men of Israel, we are come from a far country. Therefore, make a treaty with us. To the people who were outside of Canaan, God allowed a treaty to be made, but the people that were inside of Canaan, they were to be destroyed and removed from those areas and had the chance, obviously, to leave those areas so that they wouldn't be in the path of Israel taking this over. Somehow the people of Gibeon, they must have had quite a way of finding this out. They had somehow learned that Israel had been prohibited from making any treaties with the people who lived inside of the land of Canaan. We know this is true by Deuteronomy 7 and verse 1. Deuteronomy 7 and verse 1. Let's read here. Now, this is how you're supposed to treat these people who lived in the land of Canaan. And when the Lord your God shall bring thee into the land where you go to possess it in this land of Canaan, and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, as it goes on, seven nations greater and mightier than you, doesn't matter their size, I will cast them out and cause you to win this battle. And when the Lord your God shall deliver them before you, you shall smite them. Notice there's probably not too many coexistence bumper stickers going with them at this time. It's quite different. No coexist, well, whatever their beliefs are, we'll just have them be with us. You shall smite them and utterly destroy them, and you shall make no covenant with them. no agreement with them, nor show mercy unto them. Sounds very harsh, doesn't it? And sometimes people get this idea, God was very harsh there. Moses and Joshua knew that if a treaty or a covenant was made with any of the people of Canaan, that it would cause Israel to not follow God. And this is the important purpose of it. It would lead to having a relationship with them, and it would lead to eventually marrying into those people that were left there. And we saw that this happened later, and Israel married into them, and they were drawn away where they didn't follow God. It was not that interracial marriage was wrong. It was because they would marry someone who did not share the same beliefs with them, and they would be drawn away easily. It goes on here in verse 3. Neither shall you make marriages with them. This is what's going to happen if you leave them. Don't make any marriages with them. Your daughter, you can't give her unto his son, nor his daughter unto your son. And here's the whole point, the critical verses here in verse 4. For they will turn away your son from following me, that they may serve other gods. Israel was weak enough, you know, with their own human nature. But to mingle with these other people would draw them away, and Israel would be gone. So, if this happens, that they may serve other gods, so will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you and destroy you suddenly. You know, just like I helped you destroy these people that were in your path, so it could happen to you. But thus shall you deal with them. You shall destroy their altars, break down their images. Don't leave any of this behind. Cut down their groves where they did this worshiping. Burn their graven images with fire. Those were all against God. So we know that this is how they are to deal with the people that are within the land of Canaan. Going back to Joshua 9, we'll continue on here now in verse 7. Verse 7. And the men of Israel said unto the Hivites, this is the people of Gibeon, they didn't know that that's who they were, they have been misled, and it says here, let's just say you dwell amongst us, and how shall we make a treaty with you? Here's this issue of a treaty being brought up. We are from outside of Canaan, they are projecting this, we want to make a treaty with you. And they said unto Joshua, we are your servants. So they're projecting this. And Joshua said unto them, who are you? He's asking this question of himself, by himself. And from whence do you come? They also seem to be aware of God's instruction regarding the treatment of Israel's enemies who did not live in the land of Canaan. There was a difference. People outside the land of Canaan were treated differently, and that's why the people of Gibeon are projecting this. The people outside of Canaan were to be treated differently from those that were in the promised land. Look here with me in Deuteronomy 20 and verse 10. There is a difference. Deuteronomy 20 and verse 10. We'll see here. And when you come nigh unto a city to fight against it, doesn't say it's inside of Canaan, then proclaim peace unto it. Quite different, isn't it? Outside the land of Canaan, proclaim peace unto it. And it shall be, if they want to make peace, be open unto them to make peace. Then shall it be that all the people that is found therein shall be servants unto you, and they shall serve you. So Gibeon is trying to project that they are people who could be servants. They would be preserved, wouldn't be destroyed, wouldn't go through all of this. We'll go on to verse 15. Thus shall you do unto all the cities which are very far off. This is a stipulation. Not within Canaan, but outside of it. Outside of it. Which are not the cities of these nations. But of the cities of these people, which the Lord your God does give you for an inheritance, thou shalt save alive nothing. That means those within Canaan are not to be preserved or saved alive at all. But you shall utterly destroy them, namely the Hivites, the Amorites, the Canaanites. They're talking to the Hivites right here, the people from Gibeon. And the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you. Let's go on to Joshua 9 and verse 9. So this projection of who they were, so that their lives would be preserved, is given to Joshua. You know, in all of this, Joshua is not going to God and asking for an answer. He doesn't go to God and ask, how should I make this decision? Who are these people? He's kind of just left it to himself to make this decision. So we see here in Joshua 9 and verse 9, and they said unto him, from a very far country your servants are come because of the name of the Lord your God, for we have heard of the fame of him. Went before them, didn't it? Before they actually came to these towns, the people knew what was going to happen. This gossip or this knowledge of it happened. We have heard of the fame of your God and all that he did in Egypt and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites. You know, they didn't even need the internet. They didn't even need a cell phone. Somehow they were able to know ahead of time. And all that you did unto the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, to Og, king of Bashan, which is at Ashtaroth. So, like Rahab, we can think of this comparison. The Gibeonites believed all the reports about the God of Israel, and they sought to make an agreement with his people so that they could be spared from a certain death. Yes, the Gibeonites lied to Joshua. Rahab lied to protect the people that she was protecting there, the spies. Let's continue on with this story. Verse 11 of Joshua 9. Wherefore our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, take victuals with you for the journey, and go to meet them, and say unto them, we are your servants. Therefore, now make a league or a treaty with us, reiterating this again. Notice, our bread we took hot out of the oven for our provision, out of our houses, on the day that we came forth to go unto you. But now, behold, it is dry and moldy. All lies, but they're portraying this in this way. And these bottles of wine, notice, they were filled when we left. They were new, and behold, now they're empty. And these garments and our shoes are become old by reason of this very long journey. We've just about worn them out. And the men took of their victuals and asked not counsel at the mouth of the Lord. Notice, Joshua does not go to God, does not appear before the Ark of the Covenant, does not use the Urim and the Thummim to ask God, what should I do? This is a major decision. If Joshua had asked God about these people, God would have told them who they were. I'm convinced that he would have. This was a major mistake on Joshua's part. We don't have recorded mistakes on Joshua's life, except for, I think, just this one. I don't think I had read about this mistake or remembered it, but this is significant. Going on to verse 15. And Joshua made peace with them and made a treaty with them, my King James says league, to let them live. And the princes of the congregation swore unto them. That means they both agreed to it. A contract. A covenant was made here between them. So now, how does this all work out in verse 16? And it came to pass at the end of 3 days. Boy, this news had circulated back to Joshua, got back to them, however this works. After they had made a league with them, that they heard that they were their neighbors. They lived within Canaan. They had deceived them, and that they dwelt among them. This had to have been a jaw-dropper for Joshua. What have I done? What have I done to make this agreement, this treaty with them? How did Joshua handle this? How did he deal with this? Verse 17, and the children of Israel, I'm sure, promptly journeyed and came unto their cities around Gibeon on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon, Shephirah, Beeroth, Kirjath-Jearim. Here's my note about the Ark of the Covenant and the Tabernacle. You'll find that the Ark of the Covenant was in Kirjath-Jearim, and that the Tabernacle was there in Gibeon. You'll find this back in 2 Chronicles 1, 3 and 4. They were not together at this point. They had been separated prior to this from Shiloh. And the children of Israel smote them not, because the princes of the congregation had sworn unto them by the Lord God of Israel. They had made a contractual agreement, if you will, a covenant, and all the congregation murmured, grumbled against the princes. Probably had this happen in your life sometimes. Made a contract on something, purchased something, a car, a house, whatever. Later, here are these unknown factors in it that I didn't realize. You know, it isn't what I thought it was going to be. So these grumblings were because Israel did not want to go through another situation like what happened with the wrong that happened at Ai the first time, the first battle. They're a little leery. Is God going to punish us now because we've made this bad decision? Verse 19, but all the princes said unto all the congregation, we have sworn unto them by the Lord. We have made an agreement with the God of Israel with them. Now, therefore, we may not touch the people of Gibeon. This was the decision that needed to be made. The leaders of Israel had made a treaty with the Gibeonites. They could not break this promise. Going on to verse 20. This we will do to them. So this is our decision. We will even let them live, lest wrath be upon us because of the oath which we swore and agreed to with them. And the princes said unto them, let them live, but let them be hewers of wood and drawers of water unto all the congregation, as the princes had promised. You know, this is what they had agreed to anyway, that their life would be spared in Gibeon. And Joshua called for them, and he spoke unto them, saying, you have deceived us, saying, we are from a far country, far from you, when you dwell right next door to us. You are our neighbors. Now, therefore, you are cursed, and there shall none of you be freed from being a bondman or a slave. And you shall be hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God. And they answered Joshua and said, because it was certainly told your servants how that the Lord God commanded his servant Moses to give all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. Therefore, we are sore afraid of our lives because of you and have done this thing. So this is the answer that the Gibeonites have said. We were afraid of you. We knew you had destroyed all that was before you, and we didn't want to die, and we wanted to stay in our town, in our area. Now behold, in verse 25, we are in your hand, as it seems good and right unto you to do unto us. Do what you think is right, and we want to be your servants. So this contract had been made, and so did he unto them, and delivered them out of the hand of the children of Israel, that they did not slay them. And Joshua made them that day hewers of wood, drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord, even unto this day, in the place which he should choose. So God did not punish Israel for making this decision with the Gibeonites, because they were deceived into thinking that these people were from outside of Canaan. And if they truly were from outside of Canaan, then this was a correct decision on Joshua's part. What truly was important about making treaties with other people? We'll see back here in Numbers 30. Numbers 30, verse 1. Let's review some of this. And this is why Joshua made this decision. Numbers 30 and verse 1. They had made a treaty, an agreement with hopefully God to be amongst this. And Moses spoke unto the heads of the tribes concerning the children of Israel, saying, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Here's what you're supposed to do in this decision. If a man vow a vow unto the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. The bottom line of it all. Joshua had to agree to allow them to live, but make them be servants for the temple or the tabernacle use. For Joshua, his word was his bond. His word would be tested once more. We're going to see as we go forward to Joshua 10 and verse 1. Gibeon, once again, is going to be involved in this next test. Joshua 10 and verse 1. Now it came to pass when Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, had heard how Joshua had taken Ai and had utterly destroyed it, as he had done to Jericho and her king, so he had done to Ai and her king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them. This king of Jerusalem is upset by this. He doesn't like what happened to Gibeon. All these other towns have been destroyed. Here they are being protected and made peace with Israel. Now, in reading this verse, I've often wondered why Israel had not set up in Jerusalem first. You know, it was kind of the focus of God's eye. Why? It was because they had not conquered this city yet, had not gotten to that point. And also because Joshua was the tribe of Ephraim, and the tribe of Ephraim settled around Shiloh and that area that encompassed the area that Ephraim was given. Going on to verse 2. So they feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city, as one of the royal cities. What made it a royal city? Well, we'll see here. And because it was greater than I, and all the men thereof were mighty. Gibeon was a great city at this time, like one of the royal cities, because it did not have a king. A unique government. It had a council, a group of men that ruled it. It was a great city because it had control of a primary pass to the western plains that led to Canaan. Later on, it would be one of the towns of Levi where people could go. If you'd committed a crime, you could go there and be protected. Gibeon ended up being one of those cities. That being a great city at that time didn't pertain to that, but later it would. So it had a control of a primary pass to the western plains of the land of Canaan. We'll go on to verse 3. Wherefore,
Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, sent unto Hoham, king of Hebron, unto Purim, king of Jarmuth, and unto Japhia, king of Lachish, and unto Debir, king of Eglon, saying, come unto me, we're going to get together, we're going to hash this out, and help me that we may smite Gibeon. We're not going to let them have peace with Israel. We're going to do something about it. For they have made peace with Joshua and with the children of Israel. Now, Gibeon was looked at by the non-Israelite people as defecting. You know, not being amongst those other cities that were in Canaan. These other southern cities wanted to make an example of the Gibeonites by putting together an alliance to destroy them. We're going to take care of this. They wanted to deter any other cities from following Israel. The king of Jerusalem sent for the kings of four other cities in about a 30-mile range, and this happens now in verse 5. Therefore, the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, the king of Eglon, gathered themselves together and went up, they and all their host, and encamped before Gibeon. They are ready to attack. Take it. Make an example. And they made war against it. And the men of Gibeon sent unto Joshua to the camp of Gilgal. This is where Israel was set up, encamped at this time, saying, hurry! Don't be slack! Come quickly! Save us! Help us! For all the kings of the Amorites that dwell in the mountains are gathered together against us. Now, to be a servant under Israel meant that you would be protected by Israel. Now, would Joshua continue to keep his word, his bond? Part of this treaty was that Israel would protect Gibeon from being killed. I won't take the time to go back there, but you'll find this in Joshua 9 and verse 11. We'll continue on with the story here in verse 7 of, I believe, chapter 10. So Joshua ascended from Gilgal. Immediately, it doesn't really say this, but he did. He ascended immediately from Gilgal, and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. This trek was about 20 miles. One wouldn't think that this would be too much of a trek. And it is at night, come to find out. They traveled this 20 miles at night. And the Lord said unto Joshua, fear them not, these people, these five kings that have gotten together. For I have delivered them into your hand, and there shall not a man of them stand before you. This time Joshua sought God's help and instruction, knowing what to do. Joshua therefore came unto them suddenly and went up from Gilgal all night long. All night long, this 20 miles. Not only did Israel travel 20 miles, but had to go up an incline to Gibeon that was about 3,300 feet. You'd think this would be pretty exhausting. And the Lord threw them into a panic, these five kings before Israel, and slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, and chased them along the way that goes up to Bethoron, this pass, and smote them to Azekah and unto Makkedah. God honored his promise and delivered the Amorites into the hands of Israel by creating a contagious fear that went throughout them. You know, many times we'll find that this is what God did, created a fear amongst those they were fighting against. And it came to pass as they fled from before Israel and were in the going down to Bethoron, and the Lord cast down great stones from heaven, hailstones, if you will, upon them unto Azekah, and they died. They were more which died with the hailstones than they whom the children of Israel slew with a sword. God was doing his part. This Beth Horon ascent was the location of the pass controlled by Gibeon, which led to the valley of Ajalon and westward to the coast. This event, you can see, was a type of that seventh bowl plague that we see back in Revelation 16 and verse 21, when the battle of the great day of God Almighty will occur. There's going to be hailstones that come down there too. We'll go back to verse 12 of Joshua 10. Then spoke Joshua to the Lord in the day. And I'll make a little pause here. There was more to be done, more to be accomplished to win this battle. So Joshua spoke to the Lord, sought him in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel and said in the sight of Israel, "Sun, stand still upon Gibeon." We need to finish this during the daylight. We need to accomplish this. "And you, moon, in the valley of Ajalon." And the sun stood still with his asking, and the moon stayed in its place until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is not this written in the book of Asher, a non-inspired book? "So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and hastened not to go down about a whole day." And some of the references that I've read, that this day was extended actually about 23 hours and 20 minutes. So it was just about a whole day, but not quite. Many countries have made the same comment about a time when the day was extended during this time of Joshua. The Chinese, people in Mexico, various other locations around the world noticed something peculiar about a particular day that lasted almost a day longer. And there was no day like that before it or after it that the Lord hearkened unto the voice of a man. For the Lord fought for Israel. God's mercy was upon Joshua and Israel as they fought against the kings who were against Gibeon and Israel. The miracle was a reminder that God was giving Israel the land of Canaan as he had promised. Three major miracles that Joshua had happened in his life: the stopping of the Jordan River, destruction of Jericho, and now the sun and moon remained in their position for a period of approximately 23 hours and 20 minutes. God was very merciful to Joshua. I'd like to go back to the last chapter of Joshua. If you'll follow along with me, we'll look at Joshua 24. I've always been inspired by Joshua, but reading over this again, it makes it very interesting. And Joshua is telling the people what is going to happen. His life is coming to an end. We'll start here in verse 8. Joshua 24 and verse 8. "I brought you into the land of the Amorites, which dwelt on the other side of Jordan. They fought with you and I gave them unto your hand, that you might possess their land, and I destroyed them from before you." Let's jump here to verse 13. "I have given you a land for which you did not labor, and cities which you built not to dwell in them, of the vineyards and olive yards which you planted not, and these here you're going to eat of. Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth. And put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve you the Lord." Now, Joshua and God are giving them an out here if they want to choose this. "And if it seems evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers have served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell." But Joshua says, "But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Let's continue on here. And the people answered and said, God forbid. They remembered all that had happened, all that had just recently occurred, that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. For the Lord your God, He it is, and this is the people saying this, that brought us up out of our fathers, out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage, which did those great signs in our sight and preserved us in all the way wherein we went. And among all the people through whom we passed, they remembered all this. And the Lord drove from before us all the people, even the Amorites which dwelt in the land. Therefore, we will also serve the Lord, for He is our God. And Joshua said unto the people, you cannot serve the Lord, for He is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions nor your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve strange gods, then He will turn and do you hurt and consume you. After that, He has done you good. And the people responded and said unto Joshua, no, but we will serve the Lord. And Joshua said unto the people, you are a witness against yourselves that you have chosen you the Lord to serve Him. And they said, we are witnesses. What is happening here? A covenant is being made and struck here with these people. Now we're going to go forward to verse 25. So Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and set them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem. And Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God and took a great stone. And many times they did this. They're crossing the Jordan River, left stones in the river, and also when they came out of it, set stones. Yes, we know that God has been there, and we agree to what God requires of us. So, here this great stone is set up under an oak that was by the sanctuary of the Lord. And Joshua said unto all the people, behold, this stone shall be a witness unto you. You know, we can't just say, oh, we didn't quite understand it. We didn't quite understand the agreement. It's written in stone, the agreement that had been made. For it has heard all the words of the Lord which He spoke unto us. It shall be therefore a witness unto you, lest you deny your God. Let's go on here to verse 31. We'll conclude here. And Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua and which had known all the works of the Lord that He had done for Israel. So what is the theme of all of this? What had occurred? I'll read this, what I found. The main theme of this book that we have gone through is that the attainment of the promised land requires overcoming and defeating the enemy which stands in their way. The people that lived there were their enemies. They weren't their friends. It is clear that the acquisition of the promises of God can only come to those who receive His direction and help. Joshua did a misstep, didn't he, when he didn't seek God's help in finding out who those people were that he made this agreement with. For those who look to God for direction, and we could say this of us too, can't we? We can't just say it was just for ancient Israel. It's true for us today. For those who look to God for direction and rely on Him for help in overcoming the enemy, He will give them rest by fulfilling His promises. I enjoyed the study of these couple of books that we read through. Lessons to be learned about our honor, our word, our bond, and how God needed to guide these people, and they needed to seek God for His direction. So with that, we'll conclude the sermon.